accuracy historically. In fact, most scholars will claim that it used to be back to about 800 B.C., but now they go back to about 1000 B.C. and say there's pretty good evidence for everything that the Bible claims to have happened. The places are where they're supposed to be, the kings. There's evidence that there were people of such a name. And so the stories of the Bible are beginning with about the time of David, are pretty well accepted by many, many scholars. But the period before that, they're still debating about whether Moses was real or not. That seems strange to us, but there's some people who aren't really sure about what the Exodus was a myth and that sort of thing. That will be uncovered, I'm sure, in coming years. But when you go back to the flood, we're going to see in one of the coming lessons how far back that was. It's amazingly far back, thousands of years back to the time of Noah. And yet there's evidence that it really happened. And that's the take home of this whole course. We're spending 2 months to reinforce in your mind the fact that Noah and the ark and the flood were real events. And if the Bible is true back that far, then we'll see in the end, in the last lesson, you have to reconsider your thinking about, if you're a scientist and believe in atheistic evolution, you got to reconsider that too, because the creation comes into view at that point. And there's the evidence that the ark exists and that Noah was a real person and that the flood happened casts a great shadow over a lot of modern biology. And that's one of the secondary purposes of this course, that will give you some information to tell your children when they're faced in school with the assertion that there is no God and that it all just sort of happened by chance. That can't be the case anymore because of the evidence that the flood happened. And so that's a consequence of that, and I want to show that to you. And it takes a while to get the information across because there's a little bit of something called genetics that we have to talk about, and how life works. And so we got to spend a little bit of time on that at the end. And that's the thing that I did in my career, was to study genetics. And so I'll try to lead you through that. But it's pretty straightforward. Don't be afraid of it. You can understand it. And it's a common information once it's put together right. But today our purpose is to look at the design and structure of the ark. Now, I've shown you some pictures of what's sitting there. And last week we looked at how they analyzed what was there without digging it up. The Turkish government will not allow archaeologists to dig into it yet. I suspect at some point they will. At least I'm hopeful that they will. But whether they do or not, there was some non-destructive testing that went on that we talked about last week, where they took radar across the top of the thing and looked internally, subsurface radar, look at the structure underneath to see where the major walls and things like that were in the ark. And then we looked at the distribution of iron. And that's an important thing, because you think about people knowing how to work iron thousands of years ago, long before the Iron Age, and most of the scholars who've learned the routine things in school will say, well, that's impossible. Before the Iron Age, no one knew how to work iron. And that's clearly not the case anyway, but obviously here, iron was used extensively in the structure of the ark. So we know those things, and I gave you in the pictures that you have, there's a diagram down there on this side showing you the kinds of structure that's in the ark. Now, today we're going to just do some imagination kinds of exercises. If we have the information that we have, can we imagine how Noah might have gone about putting this thing together? And a lot of A lot of critics look at this and say, well, if you build a boat that big, it can't withstand stormy seas, and so that's an impossible proposition. But of course, if you're looking at the ark at the elevation of 6,200 feet in the mountains and wonder how it got there, then it's not a matter of is it possible, but it's a matter of how did it happen. So we'll examine their criticisms too in the course of our discussion today. Let's get started here. This is what we're beginning with. Someone commented that they found this on Google Earth and looked at it, and it is somewhat eroded today from what it was when this picture was made 25 years ago. But this is basically what was found in the 1950s. And so it's a boat-shaped structure. It's got structure along the sides of it, and sits up near the top of one of these lesser mountains in Mount Ararat. It's in a flow of material coming down the side of the mountain, a mixture of ash and mud and debris and some lava. And so it was on its way down the hill, sliding slowly down the hill from up here somewhere, when it got impaled in the side amidships here on an outcropping of rock. It was thrust up against this wall. You're standing on a hill overlooking it, and so it stopped it, and it didn't go on down into the ravine to its destruction yet. That may happen someday. It may fall apart. It is weathering, and it won't last forever. But it's been there for a while. It's been there for over 50 years now, where men have gradually come to realize it's something we need to study. Now, we spent one whole lesson talking about how big it was. And we came to the conclusion that a cubit isn't 18 inches like it is in your NIV Bible, where it translates 300 cubits as 450 feet. It's actually 515 feet from the bow back here, or from the stern back here to the bow uphill there. It's pointing somewhat to the south. Now, if we lay a 515-foot boat into this view, this is how we took the material that we had from the radar and the iron studies, and this was the kind of internal structure that we can deduce from the material from without digging into it. You can see that there are walls and things in it, and if you lay a 550-foot boat over that impression in the dirt, you can see how it could have a fairly constant width, and it's 515 feet long, and it should be, well, we'll see in a minute what the width should be. It's somewhat spread apart in the middle, so the outline of it is wider. When it hit that rock, it evidently disintegrated in the middle somewhat. So it's wider and spread apart amidships. All right. So that's the kind of information that we start with. Now here's another view of the outline of the boat as it sits. And you can see this is later on from that first picture, and you can see that there's been some erosion of the structure up in here. It's covered with grass, and there are sheep grazing on it from time to time. If you go down into the valley, you can get up onto the top of it here through this rock outcrop area, or down here at the stern. You can see where the ribs were, and we talked about how they scraped the dirt off of the ribs, and you could see that the ribs are something over a foot wide, and we don't know how deep into the boat they go, but probably a couple of feet. Pretty good-sized trees that were used to make the ribs of the boat. Now, let's lay in that, our 515-foot boat. And there you can kind of see what it looked like before it fell apart. Actually, this end of it up here is a little bit moved toward us. It should be a little further away, but I wanted to get the bow and superimposed at that end. So you can see that the ribs that we can see here, which run from about there up, the rest of them are in shadow over here. you can see that that's a pretty good length of rib for the side of the boat when it's that size. Here's the door in the side of the boat. And next week, we're going to take the details of chapters 6, 7, 8, and 9, particularly 6, 7, and 8 of Genesis, and look at them verse by verse. I want you to have read that now by next week. I've been asking you week by week to go through that material for yourself and look at what it says with the picture that we've been talking about in your mind. You can kind of see the realism that's involved in the description of it in Genesis. So be sure and read that now before next week, because we're going to look at it in detail. So we can place a boat like that in there and see how it's kind of fallen apart, because it's been there thousands of years. It's fossilized. The wood is turned to stone. It no longer has the strength that it had as wood, and it's kind of collapsed. It's 86 feet wide, 52 feet high. Now, how high is this room in here? Who's the architect who designed our building here? We're talking about maybe 20 feet, is that? No? He's 30 to way up here, 30 feet. So it goes on up, if you're standing inside the ark, it goes on up almost twice as high, maybe twice as high as it is up to these beams. So that gives you have trouble getting a feel for this, and I'll show you a picture in a little bit that'll give us a little bit better realism involved as we try to imagine this. Those of you who have boats, it's just impossible to think about a boat this big. Now, how do you construct a boat that big? We saw that there were ribs along the sides of the boat. They had taken the shovels, you remember, and scraped the dirt off of it, and you could see where the fossilized wood was that made up the ribs. So in constructing a boat like this out of timber of some sort, we don't know what kind of wood, and with three decks, remember that he says make three decks in it? And there's going to be a covering over the top of it. So you can imagine a frame like this that he made, he and his sons, and he could hire workers, other people who would basically make fun of his project, but if he paid them, they'd do it, of course, work for him. And I imagine he was a good person to work for. And so you make 100 of these. I don't know how many it takes to go all the way to the end, but you can replicate the basic frame of the thing. And every so often, there's what we call a bulkhead that is a reinforced. We were talking about that last week. The bulkheads, the watertight bulkheads in the Titanic failed because they didn't go all the way up in the ship. But the bulkheads in the ark don't have to be watertight. Why? Well, God's not going to let the ship leak, okay? We look at this thing and we think, how did Noah do all of this? And you have to realize it's not his design, and God gave him the help that he needed, and he had 100 years to do it. So if he only made one of these basic frames every 2 or 3 months, he had plenty of time to get the whole thing together before the time came for the flood. So you put all of these together, and somehow you get the supports for the decks inside there. You got cross bracing that has to go in there as well. And then, of course, you put planking along the sides. And you look at that ark laying there in Mount Ararat, and you say, well, where's the side planking that made it watertight, of course? Well, once they got to where they were going, that was used for construction of houses and stuff. They could rip that off the sides of the ark and use it for building the places to live once they got there. And that's another thing we have to keep in mind. What was the lifespan of this boat? If you invested 100 years in building a boat, you would you would certainly want it to last another 100 years, I suppose, if you were using it for pleasure or something like that. You don't want to do what we did here. Noah built this boat to last how long? Just a little over a year. How many voyages is it going to make? Just one, okay? It doesn't have to be used over and over and over again. It just has to survive once. And so it's in a stormy sea with waves everywhere. We'll talk about that in a minute. But God, who took all of the pains to get the thing built and loaded and set afloat, he can also still the storm, can't he? So there are interventions here that the atheist doesn't want to do, of course. But the fact that the boat's there negates his complaints, because it did survive. It was relatively intact until the ages have disintegrated it. So here's kind of the way the thing goes together. You make these frames and you stick them, you support them on the ground. You build this thing on dry ground, of course. And you don't have to build it on the seashore. If the whole world is going to be flooded, you can build it anywhere and it will eventually be picked up by the water. So he could build it. One thing he probably wanted to do was build it in an area where there weren't any trees, but not before he started. He could start in a forest and convert the forest to the ark, and then he's in a treeless plain where he doesn't run into anything when the ark begins to float. So there are a number of considerations here. We aren't told any of that information, but it's just logic that these things would happen that way. Okay, so you put this together, and he goes on out here some distance, I guess out to the window or so. Now, we noted that there were bulkheads in it, that is, heavier framing material that probably had much more. They may have been solid walls, we don't really know, but they didn't have to be watertight. But to give the ark some strength, and there, I bet there was another one in here from the spacing here. We would expect this is a big gap. There was one they just couldn't detect. And then there's this strange box in the middle of the thing called a hull pool. It has other names too by the people who do oil drilling in the Gulf and that sort of thing. You can put a boxed-in area in the bottom of a ship if it comes up high enough so that it's above the water line on the outside. The water comes into that watertight box to the same level as it is outside the ship. That gives the people in the ship, the animals as well, access to the sea without having to go outside. And that gives someone drilling an oil or a gas well underwater access to the sea without having the awkward business of having to do it overboard somehow. So there was apparently a box like that here in the middle, and that's where they dropped their sea anchors, their drogue rocks that kept the ship oriented in the waves and in the currents. So that's a structure that's in the middle of it, and then you have these decks. So that's basically what we can see. I don't know why this was constructed this way at the end. That's just what the evidence showed, that it was reinforced at this end. And maybe it was at the other end too, and the material has decayed away. Now, if you drill into this, and that's been done. People have drilled from the surface and from the sides. There are vacant spaces all the way through this. If we ever get to dig into it, there are going to be rooms. Some of them are filled in, of course, with decay, but others of them apparently are still intact. So there are vacant spots in the thing, voids, which presumably were the rooms, and that's something that God specified that the ark should have, rooms within on the decks. Now, something about that hull pool. Here you can see what we're talking about. The water comes in to this opening in the bottom of the boat, to the same level as it is outside. And you have a window at the top that runs all the way around the ship. Within it's one cubit high, so it's about like so. And it's at the very top under the roof. Now, as the water rises and falls in the waves out here, the water in this hull pool goes up and down. And you can see what effect that has as the water goes down. It sucks air into the, particularly into the top deck. And as the water goes back up, the air is expelled through these windows. And the ship is constructed in a way that it can breathe. And do you know how important that would be if you were in this ship with all these animals? Would it be important that it breathe? Yes, it would. And that apparently is one of the benefits of having the hull pool in there. And also you can drop these anchors. This anchor is too big in proportion to the ship, but nonetheless, ventilation is important. Now, it may be that the bottom decks aren't ventilated very well, and they also suffer from another deficiency. The top deck can have some light coming in from this window all the way around the edge of it, and we'll look at that picture. If you see the picture on the page that you have here, right underneath the roof, there's a line that goes across, and you can see it goes across the stern of the ship. And we think that that window went all the way around, and so that admits light. You have to wonder, well, how did they keep the ocean out? Well, the ship is so big that you're way above most of the waves, but if there's a tsunami wave or something comes across, then that's another question, but it probably doesn't put a whole lot of water into the ship. So, the top deck, I think, is where you would have most of the animals. What do you do with the second and the third deck and the bilge? Is that what's the bottom part? Well, you've got to have a lot. There's one thing else besides just the animals. You've got to have food, don't you? And water for all of these animals. And so the bottom decks could be used for storage. Wouldn't need a whole lot of light down there. They could carry some kind of light with them as they went in to remove materials. Not only was that food necessary during the time of the voyage, but after they landed, there wasn't anything much for animals to eat, and so they probably continued to be fed from the stores of the ark for a few years until they began to scatter over the earth and the plants recovered. So these are important considerations that we think about. Last week we talked about rivets and washers that were used to put the beams together. And I have here an illustration we talked about before, that you make a rivet that's split at one end so that when you put it through the beams, then you can spread the ends of the rivet here and there. And that's what this blue arrow means up here. The rivet can be spread, and not just one. You might, in fastening two beams together, you might put 8 or 10 rivets through it. These rivets are made out of iron, and the iron is rusted. Most of it is rusted away. Some of it has been protected, and so there apparently are thousands of these scattered just under the surface and on the surface when they first went in to look for it. A rivet with a washer. And so you put a washer on the rivet, put it through the hole, and then put another washer on the end of it and then spread it out. And that's how the fasteners were made. And we asked last week, how do you make the rivets? We talked about a verse of scripture that in Genesis 4, now this is before the flood, that one of Cain's descendants was a man named Tubal Cain who forged all kinds of tools out of bronze and iron. Now, the Bronze Age came before the Iron Age. The reason for that is that iron is difficult to handle. I'm going to cough. That's the way to do that, isn't it? The iron has to be smelted from rust, essentially from oxidized and sulfide combined iron. And so it's a difficult thing to do, and it requires very high temperatures and just the right kind of an environment to get metallic iron from ores. But it doesn't say that he smelted iron. It just says he forged iron. So what does it mean to forge iron? And what is a natural source of iron? Someone knew the answer last week. What was it? What? Meteorites. There are, I read some material about that. There's 5 to 7% of the meteorites that are found on the surface of the earth are iron meteorites. They're made out of iron with varying amounts of nickel. And they come from the cores of asteroids that have smashed together and fractured the body into small, well, to smithereens, is that the term we would use? And so the pieces are flying around in the solar system, and some of them impinge on the earth. They come through. Many of the smallest ones burn up in the atmosphere, but the larger pieces come to the surface, and of course, some of them, that's the largest canyon, Diablo. The IAB is one of the classifications of iron meteorites, and it's octahedrite, which tells you that it's a form of iron, metallic iron. And there are iron objects historically that precede the Iron Age, and it's always thought that they were made from forged meteorites. If you take a smaller meteorite, say something as big as your fist, and heat it up and pound on it with a hammer on an anvil, you can shape it into different things. And there are famous daggers that had been made of iron before the Iron Age, and that's how those things came to be. Well, it may be that in the early days after creation that the earth was littered with iron meteorites. We don't know from what source or from where they came from, but that you could pick up and no one knew what to do with them. But Tubal-Cain figured out what to do. You heat them up, hit them with a hammer, and you can make all kinds of things out of them. And of course, a big one like this would be hard to heavy. It weighs a ton or more. So, if you can make a rod out of iron, and incidentally, you can take 2 or 3 meteorites and heat them up, and you can combine them together and pound on them again and heat them up and fold them together and pound on them. And you can make an iron rod out of it. And then you fold the thing in two and melt the end where the iron pieces are joined together. Then you make a rivet which you can bend out at any point along its length depending on the thickness of the pieces that you're sticking together. And of course, you have to be able to make washers. Can you make a washer out of a piece of iron? You pound it into a flat plate and then take a chisel or something and take the center out of it and smooth it up. It's possible. For a good blacksmith can make a washer without much difficulty. So Tubal-Cain was a blacksmith, but doesn't necessarily mean that he was able to make the iron from ores. Now the critics look at the ship made out of wood, 500 feet long. And they say any boat made that way, it has a basic flaw in its design that is illustrated in this sort of a diagram. Whenever the waves approximate, the wavelength approximates the length of the boat. Then when when the ship is basically on the wave, we have the waves, the waters completely washed out on the ends, but just to make it clear, if this is the boat and this is the water, when the wave peak is in the middle of the boat and the trough is at each end of the boat, then the ship is flexed by the weight of the boat and bent upward, the force in the middle pushes it up. And then after the wave moves on, then it's the other way around. The force is down on the middle of the ship and up on the ends of the ship. And that constant flexing of the ship back and forth will do what to its structure? It'll break it, won't it? Given enough of that. And it may be that it takes a few years before the fatigue sets in a ship. And we have lost ships famous ships. There was an ore carrier on the on Lake Michigan, I think, that somebody remember what that one was. It's been the what? The Fitzgerald. That apparently suffered, that's right, that's the name of it, apparently suffered this kind of damage, and it was an iron ship, but it was heavily laden with iron ore. And of course, if it's heavily laden, it's the weight of the ship is a greater pressure on the structure of the ship. And they say, well, it doesn't matter how, the critic says, it doesn't matter how you brace the ship, the structure of the wood will give way eventually. And that may well be true, given the seas like this. We have no idea what the seas were like in the flood, although I suspect they were pretty fierce seas. A bigger ship, of course, is more stable in troubled waters than a little ship where you're tossed up and down. Many of you may have been in a case like that. But then we have this story in the New Testament, which the critic gives this no value at all, but of course we understand it pretty easily. One day Jesus said to his disciples, let's go over to the other side of the lake. And so they got into a boat and set out. As they sailed, he, that is Jesus, fell asleep. A squall came down on the lake so that the boat was being swamped, and they were in great danger. Were they really in great danger? Well, they were, if you look at that and say, these silly men went out there when there's a storm coming up and they're being swamped and they deserve their fate. So the disciples went and woke Jesus, saying, Master, Master, we're going to drown. And I'm sure they felt that way. He got up and rebuked the wind and the raging waters, and the storm subsided. And all was calm. Where's your faith? He asked his disciples. In fear and amazement, they ask one another, who is this? He commands even the winds and the water, and they obey him. Would the winds and the water obey God in the flood? So that the space around the ark didn't suffer the violent waves that other places did. And of course, that's a possibility. The critic doesn't like that kind of intervention. He doesn't want science to be affected by supernatural events anyway. But the fact that the ark is there and that it survived intact and came through this year plus time says that somebody's taking care of them. And if you think about that, not only is God protecting Noah, but we'll see next week, God had a contract with Noah to carry him through this event. He's not going to abandon him. God is going to help him to survive the event. And we'll look at that next week. I'll make a covenant with you and with the animals, incidentally, to protect them. Now, we also have talked not long ago, I guess Ken was telling us about the it was in our Thursday morning community Bible class. We were talking about the Garden of Eden. And after Adam and Eve were expelled from the Garden of Eden, the garden was guarded by cherubim at the gates to keep them from going back into the garden. But when we get to this event, the garden's going to be destroyed by the flood, and the cherubim are needed for that event. I suspect that the cherubim were helping with the animals in this situation too. Maybe unseen in the situation, or maybe they appeared among the inhabitants of the ark in some way to calm the animals and to make the whole event bearable. So we don't really know about any of that. It isn't spoken of in the Bible, but we can't dismiss those kinds of influences on the event and say, well, it's not possible for this to happen. I won't believe it. But that's the result you get when talking with someone who's an evolutionist. But because they realize, I think they're beginning to realize, the implications of the flood on what they have been preaching for the last 50 or 100 years in our school systems. All right, now I'll leave you with a picture from a children's book. I meant to bring that this morning. I forgot to bring it. By Peter Spears. Any of you ever see that before? It's a very, very interesting book. I think you can buy it probably in a used bookstore, Half-Price Books or something, and beautifully illustrated about Noah the Ark. And here's his picture of the interior of the Ark, where Noah, is here. Noah got the duty of cleaning out the stalls, and one of his sons is over here feeding the giraffes, and another son is back here hauling in water. And they had to work to keep all of these animals fed and happy and alive in a situation that would be difficult. I don't know that I could take a ride on a boat like this in a stormy sea and survive. I get seasick when I get in a boat like that. But they managed to do it, didn't they? And you wonder, how hard did they have to work? And you can't imagine all of these animals. Now, there's another way in which God could have helped the situation that isn't expressed in the Bible, but it's obviously something that could have happened. He has to take pairs of animals, we'll see next week, male and female. But it doesn't say that they're full grown, does it? Could he take a pair of baby chicks instead of full grown chickens? Well, if he could do that, you see, he could take a pair of baby alligators. He doesn't have to fight the ones that are this long. Of course, God could calm the animals so that they're not afraid of man, and so that they cooperate, and they learn very quickly that he's the one that's feeding us, and so they don't struggle in the situation, and they actually make the whole thing a little bit easier. He doesn't have to take full-grown dinosaurs. Now, they look at that and say, how do you get a 6,000-ton behemoth on board? He doesn't have to take it full grown. He only has to take it grown enough so that he can tell male and female so that he can get a pair. You see how the critics try to make this so big and so impossible that you give up on it, but they don't think about all the possibilities. Or maybe they do and they wouldn't admit the possibilities. I suspect that's true too. The other thing is, Noah didn't have to go out and gather all these animals. We'll mention that again next week. Some people say, well, it's impossible to go get all of these things and herd them in. But that's not how it happened, did it? God sent the pairs to Noah when he was ready to load the ark. God enforced some sort of migratory behavior on these animals so that they came to Noah at the right time. And in a world in which there were no seasons like we have now, they didn't have summer and winter until after the flood. That shows up at the end of the flood. So they're living in a world that's fairly uniform in temperature, and the animals come to Noah and wait to board the ship at the right time. And so Noah didn't have the difficulty of locating and fighting and trapping and all of that. That's not how the story goes. Well, if God controls their migratory behavior, they're going to be turned out into a world that's different from the world they came from. They're going to be turned out into a world that has summer and winter. So now many of these animals are going to have to hibernate in the wintertime. And in fact, during the time of the flood, the world may have already turned pretty cold. Now, there's enough body heat in the ark to keep it warm. They don't have to light any fires. But God could well have put many of these animals to sleep in hibernation through much of this, particularly the first 40 days when the when the storms raged. They may have gone aboard and went right to bed and were no trouble at all until they began to wake up and say, "I'm hungry," and Noah and his sons had to get to work feeding them. Now, they had a way to dump the extra stuff, the the produce of the animals, overboard. They had a way to dispose of the garbage. They had. If you look at this, it all seems to be pretty workable. Ken had a point to make. The animals will fear you, he says, after the flood. And it may well be that at the time and before the flood, that animals and men, the animals were not afraid of men. And so that would be very helpful, wouldn't it? So you see, we look at that story sometimes with preconceived ideas and think about how it would be if we tried to do that today. And I want you to keep that in mind, because we can't do it today. It's not possible to redo the flood, even if there was going to be a flood. We couldn't build a boat. We couldn't keep this many animals together, and we certainly couldn't repopulate the animal world from pairs of animals on the ark. And that's the bottom line we're going to talk about at the end of the course. Well, we have a few minutes left this morning. Do any of you have any questions or comments things you've been wondering about that maybe we can touch on, or we can study this next week and come up with some answers? Anybody? Yeah, why didn't he say, okay, we'll wipe everything out, we'll start over and recreate man, for that matter? Why did he bother saving some of the animals from before the flood and turning them loose after the flood? Any ideas? It really wasn't the animals' fault, was it, that the world was full of evil? But he could have. But he didn't. What do you think? I'm sorry, what? Say again, please. Oh, sure. That's another, you can go another step, can't you? You can wipe everybody out with the sun exploding or something. Yeah, you can kill all. Yeah, why go through the business of even having a flood? I'm sorry? A promise he made to Adam and Eve, is that what? To Adam and Eve, what promise? There's a Savior and a serpent battling, aren't there? There are things going on behind the scenes that we can't see. And he had already promised at the time of that Adam and Eve ate of the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, that there was going to come a day of reckoning, wasn't there, when Satan would bruise the heel of the seed of woman, but he would crush the head of the serpent. So there's some promises made and some plans that God has that he's going to find a way to fulfill. What precedent is that, Ken? Judgment is waiting, isn't it? I thought about that, and we really don't have time in this course to look at the details of that, but there's a couple of chapters in Revelation that speak to that question about judgment of the first earth. Peter said in the third chapter of 2 Peter that the world that then was destroyed by water, and the world that now is reserved for destruction by fire. We live in a different world. But this business of judgment is important. And in chapters 5 and 6, particularly toward the end of, let me get that for you. And there's one verse of Scripture that I can read to you that will make that clear. And I think it refers to the flood. You might remember in chapters 4, 5, 6, particularly 5, 6, and 7, and that the Christ is opening seals and history is occurring. And I think that goes back to the very beginning. Chapter 4 talks about creation. Chapter 5, they found someone who would save man. And then in chapter 6, it says, I watched as he opened the sixth seal. There was a great earthquake. The sun turned black like sackcloth. This is in verse 12. Made of goat hair, the whole moon turned to blood red, and the stars and the sky fell to earth as late figs drop from a fig tree when shaken by a strong wind. The sky receded like a scroll. That's where that verse comes from in the songs that we sing. Rolling up, and every mountain and island was removed from its place. And the kings of the earth, the princes, the generals, the rich, the mighty, and every slave and every free man hid in caves and among the rocks of the mountains. They fled to the mountains and to the caves. They called to the mountains and the rocks, fall on us and hide us from the face of him who sits on the throne and from the wrath of the Lamb, for the great day of their wrath has come. And who can stand? And this flood was a judgment upon an evil world. Well, we'll talk about that next week, because we're going to look at the details of chapters 5, 6, or 6, 7, and 8, particularly in Genesis. And please be sure you've read that. Anybody's version will work, and we'll talk about that next week. Thank you.